This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world development. Sam Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Egyptians will learn through a very, very hard experience that you have to have a carrot and a stick, and it seems as though the effort in the Sinai is just the stick.
That's David DeRoche, an expert on Middle East security, talking about Egypt's current military effort to crack down on terrorism in the Sinai. Details coming up. Also, Cyril Ramaphosa will be giving his first State of the Nation speech as President of South Africa shortly. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, in just about an hour from now, Cyril Ramaphosa will be giving his first State of the Nation speech as President of South Africa. His speech caps more than a week of tension as his ruling African National Congress worked to get President Jacob Zuma to resign. Zuma stepped down Wednesday night, and yesterday Ramaphosa was sworn in office. VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell speaks with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about what's expected for the speech.
Well, the State of the Nation address is an opportunity and an obligation for the President of South Africa to address the people on how the government is performing in every sector. So for the last 9 years, at least, Jacob Zuma has addressed every part of that. He's discussed education, he's discussed health, he's discussed agriculture, he's discussed the economy, and so on and so forth. So we are expecting to get the same format from President Ramaphosa. However, the thing that most South Africans will be listening for is what he's going to promise to do with the economy. Because we have record high unemployment right now in South Africa, the currency has been very unstable, largely because of Zuma's unpopularity and some of the decisions he's made over the last year that have been unpopular and led to instability. So Ramaphosa really needs to come out and say something not just important for the policymakers and for the economists, but he also needs to assuage the concerns of his people. He needs to be a bit plain-spoken here and say, here's how I'm going to fix the economy and improve your quality of life. And that's kind of a tall order, but he knows this going in.
Now, is his style of presentation expected to be very different from Mr. Zuma's?
Yes. Zuma was a notoriously hesitant speaker. He would speak in a halting monotone, and his delivery left a lot to be desired. Ramaphosa has also already shown that he is a much better orator than Jacob Zuma ever was. And so it will probably be a livelier speech. He'll probably be able to cover more words in less time, which is important. He'll be able to get through the speech maybe a little faster than Zuma was able to. But also, the last few State of the Nation addresses by Jacob Zuma have been marked with opposition heckling, by opposition walkouts, and even by security removing the opposition forcefully. We're not expecting much of this to happen, if any of it to happen, at this State of the Nation address. This should be in some ways, a fairly boring State of the Nation address, but one that people will be watching because they want to hear what Ramaphosa is going to be promising to them.
Now, Mr. Zuma was originally scheduled to give this speech last week, but it was postponed while the party leadership negotiated with him to have him resign. Does that indicate that the ANC considers this speech traditionally to be quite significant for its future?
This speech, I think, is important for the ANC and its main face that it represents to the public. And over the last few years, Jacob Zuma has been that face, and the ANC has not been happy about it. And they've seen that at the polls. They've seen the results of Jacob Zuma being the face of the party. The ANC sets its own policy every 5 years at its own policy conference, and that's slightly a different matter. The State of the Nation address is basically the ANC's version of showing its face to the entire country. Yes, that is supposed to, of course, entice voters to say, oh, wow, we've got a good thing here with this ANC. But this is not really a party speech. This is a government speech. It is always supposed to be a government speech. We can expect the president to say, you know, this government has done this and this and this and this to help improve the lives of the people. But he will probably refrain from saying the African National Congress has done this.
That was VOA correspondent Anita Powell in Johannesburg speaking with Kate Pond-Dawson about what's expected for President Cyril Ramaphosa's speech tonight. Sources in Ethiopia's ruling party tells VOA that they expect the country to declare a state of emergency in the wake of the prime minister's surprise resignation this week. However, it's seen as unlikely that Haile Mariam Desalegn's departure will trigger substantial political change. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Addressing the nation, Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn said Thursday he will step aside to help the country carry out reforms that would lead to peace and stability. The country has seen waves of anti-government protests since 2014. Human rights groups accuse security forces of abuses, including torture, and as many as 400 killings in response to the unrest. Thousands of people were arrested during the 10-month state of emergency that ended last August. Opposition leader Merera Gudina, who until recently was among those jailed over the demonstrations, told VOA the Prime Minister stepping down doesn't change anything.
There is really no need for celebration because it is a change within the ruling party. What the ruling party is up to, we are not sure. The Prime Minister has never been as powerful as the former Prime Minister. So very little to celebrate because of the change. In fact, the change can be backward. That's what is worrying us. There is a possibility of taking back the country to a state of emergency or whatever.
Indeed, ruling party officials tell VOA that the Council of Ministers is expected to declare a 3-month state of emergency, with the military in charge until Parliament, currently in recess, returns and approves Haile Mariam's resignation. This month has seen fresh protests, including a strike in the Oromia region, a flashpoint since 2014. Protesters have been demanding political and economic reforms. Observers say the government's heavy-handed tactics have led other groups and regions to join the protest movement, even amid conciliatory moves like the government's recent release of hundreds of people detained under the state of emergency. Gudina says the protesters' demands remain the same.
People are demanding fundamental change, the democratization of the Ethiopian state, free and fair elections, creation of independent and democratic institutions. We are behind those demands, but we are worried what the ruling party is up to, we are not sure.
The challenges before Ethiopia's government are real, says Mustafa Ali, a Horn of Africa researcher based in Kenya, who spoke with VOA.
The competition for power between the ruling elites is not addressed. The marginalization and exclusion of key ethnic communities, particularly the Oromo and Amhara, is not going to be addressed and is going to be a very serious challenge in Ethiopia, and it might spill over to other countries.
The outgoing prime minister has boasted how his administration has handled the economy since he took office in 2012. Ethiopia is slated to be Africa's second fastest growing economy in 2018. According to the World Bank, Ethiopia's economy has performed at more than double the regional average over the past decade, growing by 11% per year. The Prime Minister will remain in office until Parliament confirms his resignation. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
On Friday, February 9th, the Egyptian army launched an escalated military campaign in the North Sinai and areas of the Nile Delta, all of which have seen major terrorist attacks in the past year on both civilians and security personnel. But experts say it will take more than security measures to eradicate terrorism in Egypt. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi has the story.
The military's comprehensive plan, as stated, will include operations to clear the areas of militants, protect Egyptian society from the threats of terrorism and extremism, and address other crimes affecting security and stability. Alison McManus is Director of Research at the Washington-based Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy.
what's been lacking is a longer-term vision that would require not just this brute force, which at times we've seen has actually exacerbated the problem in that it caused greater antagonism amongst local populations, as well as the destruction of livelihoods.
McMena said military force must be supplemented with economic opportunities and good governance efforts that will make local populations partners in combating terrorism. In late November, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi declared that he would rely on enhanced measures against the extremists. He called on the military to use whatever force necessary within 3 months, an effort which is now underway. McManus links the timing of the military effort to military and political factors.
One, which would be a very positive thing, is that as opposed to previous campaigns, this time the military is gathering intelligence on the locations of strikes and the locations of terrorist hideouts, training camps, etc. The second, of course, is the upcoming presidential elections at the end of March. As we've seen, a pretty strong propaganda campaign showing the strength of the military in carrying out these operations, sort of drumming up the political support for the campaign, which could be tied to trying to build some excitement and support for Sisi in advance of the elections.
It's too early to determine the success of the campaign against the insurgency that has been developing in Sinai since 2013, or in mitigating a growing threat to Egypt's western desert. But Professor David Darosh of the National Defense University, who previously served in Sinai, argues that it will be next to impossible to fully eradicate the terrorist threat to the desert region.
There has to be some element of force. There are determined fighters here, but what you have in the Sinai is really more of an insurrection, and that requires a significant stabilization, reconstruction, and civilian government effort as well. And unfortunately, I don't think we're seeing that, which is why this insurrection has been harder to eradicate than the Egyptians thought it would be.
The Egyptian military has long operated with heavy force in North Sinai. It has been conducting regular air and land strikes, destroying fields and property in efforts to wipe out hideouts and establishing buffer zones to do exactly what has been announced in this latest effort, clear the area of militants. Professor Darosh insists that security response is necessary but not sufficient in counterterrorism efforts.
The Egyptians will learn through a very, very hard experience that you have to have a carrot and a stick, and it seems as though the effort in the Sinai is just the stick. And either one of those in isolation almost never succeeds.
Darosh said an over-reliance on a military solution has antagonized local communities that are critical to intelligence gathering and appears to have led to further radicalization. Local Bedouins in Sinai accuse government forces of indiscriminately bombing their villages as militants hide among the local population. But the Egyptian State Information Service refutes the charges. This week, the agency issued a statement criticizing the Muslim Brotherhood and what it called their terrorist allies and some international media outlets. They are propagating lies and allegations that civilians and their properties in Sinai have been affected by the comprehensive military campaign. The statement added that these allegations are part of a political propaganda war targeting the state and its political system chosen by the Egyptian people. Experts say, despite the efforts of the military, extremists have continued to carry out attacks which now constitute a high level of threat. They say the current campaign depends on the military's ability to secure long-term control over many areas of Sinai. They say that effort is especially difficult given the country's 1,000-kilometer desert border with Libya. For VOA News, Mohammed El-Shinawi, Washington.
A spike in criminal offenses committed by illegal Zimbabwe immigrants has incensed Botswana nationals who want stern action taken. Some immigrants, frustrated by lack of job opportunities in the neighboring country, turn to crime, but locals are increasingly getting agitated. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Martin Ngwenya has the details.
It is still early in the morning, but hundreds of Zimbabweans are already occupying every corner of busy streets in the Botswana capital, Habrone, in search of jobs. The majority are illegal immigrants forced out of their country due to scarce job opportunities. They scramble for every available odd job, from doing laundry to gardening, in return for food or money. But now there is a challenge, as while the number of immigrants who are job hunting skyrockets, opportunities are few. The scarcity of jobs has forced some illegal immigrants to turn to crime. In a recent incident, a 28-year-old university student was found dead in an overgrown bush in Habrone. He had been murdered for his mobile phone. 2 days after the incident, two Zimbabwean suspects were nabbed. And this is not just an isolated case, as illegal Zimbabwean immigrants continue to commit crime in Botswana. Locals are not impressed, as they say enough is enough and want authorities to act. A Habrone resident, Mr. Mpo Mutale, says the crime rate is a cause for concern and therefore necessary steps should be taken, particularly against illegal immigrants.
They are doing a lot of havoc, and we think the government should deal with them decisively. It's unfortunate that they come here and commit all crimes, all sorts of crimes that you can think of, including murder. It's high time that the government take this. We're so much disturbed.
Mr. Buhosi Tlale, who says he was once a victim of some Zimbabweans who took away his mobile phone, also demands a solution to the problem.
It is not fair for these guys to come into another country and start committing all sorts of crimes, including killings, robbery, you name them, because that ruins the reputation even for the innocent foreigners.
Hundreds of Zimbabweans pour into Botswana every day through unofficial points driven from their homeland by harsh economic conditions. But Zimbabweans' Mr. Isaiah Nkomo, a teacher in Habrone, says the desperate situation back home should not be an excuse for his fellow countrymen and women to commit crime in a foreign land.
It is regrettable to learn about illegal Zimbabweans committing crime in Botswana as a result of economic hardships back in Zimbabwe. Such people are just a minority, tarnishing the image of the majority of Zimbabweans, rendering a very good service to the economy of Botswana. Crime does not pay, and it is not justifiable at all.
The Botswana police have moved swiftly to fight crime and illegal immigration. An operation to weed out illegal immigrants was launched in December and has persisted since, with foot and horseback patrols intensified. Botswana says it spends around 1 million pula, or $100,000, every month to deport thousands of illegal immigrants to Zimbabwe. The challenge Botswana faces, however, is that deported immigrants immediately find their way back into the country. Reporting for VOA's English to Africa service, this is Martin Ngwenya in Habrone, Botswana.
23 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The head of the British charity Oxfam International is asking forgiveness for a reported scandal over sexual misbehavior by staff members in Haiti. Winnie Bianyem, Oxfam's executive director, apologized in a news conference today. She called on any woman who might have been abused by Oxfam employees to come forward so that justice can be done. Bianyima also pledged to create an oversight commission to look at the organization's culture and practices and recommend ways to improve them. The scandal broke last week after British news reports said some Oxfam staff had been involved in sex parties in Haiti. It has focused new attention on international aid groups and peacekeeping units, some of which have been accused of abusing those they care for. One of those implicated in the scandal is the former head of the group's Haiti operations, Roland van Hauwermeeren. He told Belgian television that he never paid for prostitutes or was party of any abuses. 7 years after the Libyan uprising that toppled the Libyan leader Gaddafi, the country's economy faces several challenges. They include budget deficits, a weak private sector, and high levels of corruption. Oil still dominates the economy, but the sector lacks the investment needed to maintain and improve exports. Jason Pack is the executive director of the U.S.-Libya Business Association. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the economic challenges facing Libya and what is needed to counter them.
Libya produced its most oil in 1970, 3 million barrels a day. And since that point, they've never reinvested the money to keep the infrastructure to where it needs to be to maintain or even increase production. When Gaddafi was toppled in 2011, 1.6 million barrels a day was the peak. Now we're back to 1.1 after seeing times in 2015 and 2016 were only 300,000 to 400,000 barrels. What Libya needs to get closer to the Gaddafian level of production is investment in the oil sector. It's investment to maintain. Pipelines are degrading. The storage tankers are broken. These things require investment to be maintained, but they need security and a functional government and state to allow that money to be spent wisely and for the top midstream sectors to be brought in. One thing I work on at the U.S.-Libya Business Association is trying to connect those providers of excellent technology, the Halliburtons, Fluors, Bechtels, and Schlumbergers, with the Libyan National Oil Corporation so that a healthy marriage can be made and the money can be generated for the Libyan people to jumpstart other aspects of the economy.
How critical is a renewed international support for Libya's peace and stability to achieve some sort of economic recovery to the war torn Libya?
From the Libyan angle, it's not clear whether security can come before peace or peace needs to come before there's security. So somehow the Libyan body politic needs to agree on who its leaders and its government is so that security institutions can be brought about. And without security, you can't see a regrowth of the economy because foreign investors and people who have capacity need to feel comfortable moving about the country and sending their technical expert to rebuild the pipelines, but also help build schools and roads. So anything that Libya's allies can do, whether it's the international community or regional actors like Egypt, Algeria, Tunisia, that can help bring together Libyan factions and make a roadmap for the future is sorely needed.
How about the U.S. role in Libya?
I'm happy to report that the U.S. is focusing on some of the commercial aspects. And this administration understands that business is needed to achieve peace and stability, and that America wants to do well by doing good. So it does seem that the U.S. administration is trying to help American as well as Western companies do business in Libya, and in so doing, jumpstart the Libyan economy and help create the institutions that are needed to get payment procedures working, to get letters of credit flowing, and hopefully to help the oil sector improve as a wealth generation vehicle for the Libyan people.
That was Jason Pack, the executive director of the U.S.-Libya Business Association. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrek Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Stand up!